There's still about 40 people who haven't successfully enrolled in the mastering course. Of those roughly 40 who aren't in because they've never tried, I just want you to realize that if you don't get in, if you encounter some problem, it's going to be your fault that you tried so late. So at least try. I mean, I know some of you have had some problems getting on, and that's one thing. But if you do have a problem, document the problem. Anyway, let's get back to where we were. We haven't quite finished chapter 2. We were talking about the central importance of phospholipids and what is the property of a phospholipid that allows it to form phospholipid bilayers and allowed those first cells to exist, to come into existence. It's both hydrophobic and hydrophilic, which in one word is what?
Amphipathic,
yes. So, like I said before, if you just introduce phospholipids without any life into water, they will self-assemble into a phospholipid bilayer, as we see here, simply because the tails are trying to avoid the water, in a sense, because the tails are hydrophobic. The water, of course, is hydrophilic. So in a phospholipid bilayer, we have this tail-to-tail arrangement. Tails in one monolayer facing the tails in the other monolayer. In each monolayer, the heads, which are the polar parts, are facing the aqueous environment to which they are facing, which is either the extracellular fluid or the intracellular fluid. So this is how the first little bags, cell-like structures, came into existence before there was actually any life. And that's, we owe our lives to that. A cell's plasma membrane, we're on slide 12 now. A cell's plasma membrane is more than just a phospholipid bilayer, because if you only have a phospholipid bilayer, there is a barrier, of course, and that's the important thing about it. But there are going to be some things that can get in and some things that can't get in, or through, I should say, into or out of. So the phospholipid bilayer by itself is what we call a selectively permeable or a semi-permeable membrane. Selectively permeable is the better word, the better phrase, meaning that certain things can easily pass through the phospholipid bilayer and other things can't. Well, there are some things that can't get through the phospholipid bilayer, at least very easily, that the cell sometimes needs to get through the membrane, and that's why a plasma membrane is more than just phospholipids. But the substructure, the main substructure of the plasma membrane in any cell is a phospholipid bilayer. So what is it that determines whether or not a particle easily permeates the phospholipid bilayer? Well, there are two criteria: charge and size, right? And keep in mind that the tails, which make up the thickness, the interior thickness of the bilayer, that's a hydrophobic region. So if you are a particle that is an ion, ions are fully charged, not just partially charged, they are fully charged. And therefore, even if you're small, that full charge that you have is enough to make you impermeant. So ions don't make their way through the phospholipid bilayer, at least very easily. And of course, it's not, they are utterly blocked. Certain ions do sneak through. I mean, a certain number of the millions and millions that there are do sneak through. But we still say that ions are impermeant, that the phospholipid bilayer is impermeable to ions, even small ones, like hydrogen ions. You can't get a smaller ion, right? Just nothing but a proton. On the other hand, certain things aren't fully charged but are polar. So if you're polar, that's not going to, you know, that's going to make you less permeant than you would be if you were unpolar or nonpolar. If you're nonpolar and large, you're still somewhat blocked simply because of your size. Now, the fact that you're nonpolar means you have no problem being in that hydrophobic interior where the tails are, but the size just gets in the way. So the most freely permeable particles, of course, are the smallest nonpolar particles. Things like oxygen and carbon dioxide, which is good for us, right? There shouldn't be any impediment to the diffusion of oxygen and carbon dioxide between the alveoli and the blood. It's how we ventilate. It's how we exchange our gases. All right. To 13 now. Here we're looking at some of the structural hierarchy within biology. Something that you should have gone over before, like a lot of this material. The idea here, starting at the top, is that there are successive levels of structural complexity in organisms. So, small organic molecules, which serve as building blocks, are complex together to make larger biological macromolecules, which in turn are then complex together to form larger structures, supramolecular structures, like membranes, for instance. And membranes are not found only around the cell itself, unless you're talking about a prokaryotic cell. In a eukaryotic cell like our own, there are membranes enclosing all of the membrane-bounded organelles as well, like chloroplasts and mitochondria. And then all of those are complex together to make an overall cell. So there's successive complexity as you go up these levels or down in the picture. Something I was thinking I was going to mention here, but, well, I'll repeat that later once. Let's go to 14. Notice on the right of this picture we're looking at macromolecules. And all organisms are made up of four types of macromolecules. I'm sure you've gone through this before. Macromolecule, of course, simply means big molecule. Big compared to most molecules. They're still unimaginably small from our point of view. But for molecules, they're large. And notice what they are. They are not, as a lot of people say, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and carbohydrates. What's wrong with the word carbohydrates? Why isn't carbohydrates one of the four classes of biological macromolecules? Yes, because not all carbohydrates are macromolecules. They're not all big. Carbohydrate is a real general word, just referring to the atomic structure. So there are small carbohydrates, and there are macromolecular carbohydrates, right? Glucose, for instance, is a carbohydrate, but it's not a macromolecule. It's not big. Instead, it is a monomer that you can hook together with other monomers to make a polymer, which would make it a big carbohydrate. So the big carbohydrates are polysaccharides, right? The small ones are monosaccharides. And I'm glad this book gets the distinction right. Not all books do. Some of them would say, instead of polysaccharides, they would say carbohydrates. But that's the difference. Of those four classes of biological macromolecules, three of them are officially polymers. Which one is not? Lipids. Right. Lipids aren't polymers. A polymer, which literally means many part, mer just means part, a polymer is built a special way. It's built by hooking together a bunch of monomers, or one-part subunits. Well, that's not how lipids are built, but the other three are. And their names kind of indicate that. Polysaccharides are polymers made up of monomers called monosaccharides. Now, a protein can go by a different name, right? Which is what? No? Polypeptide, yeah. Polypeptides are named not actually for their subunits, but for the bonds that occur that hold those subunits together. The subunits, the monomers of polypeptides are what? Amino acids. But a pair of amino acids are held together by a peptide bond. So when you have a bunch of amino acids strung together to make that polymer, we call it a polypeptide. And nucleic acids is a fine name for the third class of biological polymers, but it can go by a different name as well. Nucleic acids, of course, include DNA and RNA, right? But what's another name that means the same thing as nucleic acid? Polynucleotide, not nucleotide. Nucleotide is a name for the monomers they're made of. So a nucleotide is not a macromolecule, just like a monosaccharide is not a macromolecule. A nucleotide is a monomer that if you string together a bunch of them, you will make a polymer called a polynucleotide. So DNA and RNA, you can call them nucleic acids or you can call them polynucleotides. As a matter of fact, in the case of DNA, it's really two polynucleotides, two separate molecules, right? Well, we kind of talk about a single DNA molecule, but really what we call a single DNA molecule is two official molecules, two polymers, right? Each strand is its own polymer. Those aren't chemically bonded together to make one bigger polymer. They are held together by hydrogen bonds. And similarly for some proteins that really are made up of multiple polymers, each its own polypeptide. Okay, so let's go to 15. And look at biologically important macromolecular polymers. Well, we just talked about these. But notice that only the lipids are left out here because lipids are not polymers, as we just said. But proteins, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides do various functions. They're all officially polymers because of how they're built, but they have drastically different functions. And of those three, what is the most versatile? Proteins, by far, are more versatile when it comes to their use in cells. Why are they more versatile? Well, yes, that's just another way of saying they're versatile, though. Why is it that they can have so many different functions? What gives a protein its function? Its shape. Right. Proteins have the greatest variety of functions of any macromolecule. They do either directly every important job in the cell or indirectly. They help some other kind of macromolecule perform its job. So, whatever the specific function is of a specific protein, and it can be just about anything, it has that specific function because of its shape. So the versatility comes from the fact that there can be a hell of a lot of shapes if you were to design a protein. Why is it that a protein can have so many different shapes? Well, it's not a basic building block. It's made of basic building blocks.
Amino acids come with different charges and all sorts of different characteristics which provide the overall structure.
Right. And you're talking about a big variety of amino acids. Yeah. Well, that's because there are a lot of amino acids. There's a lot of choices for those building blocks when it comes to building a protein or a polypeptide versus building a polynucleotide, right? If you're building a DNA strand, if you think about it in terms of stringing beads together, you only have four types of beads to work with, right? There are four types of nucleotides used in DNA, whereas there are 20 types of amino acids, 20 bead types made. So if you're making a string of N monomers to make a polymer, you really have 20 to the nth number of possibilities with amino acids, whereas you have only 4 to the nth power for nucleic acids, which is the bigger number by far, 20 to the nth, right? Much bigger. So proteins can have just about any shape you can come up with, and there are new proteins being evolved all the time, just accidentally, right? That's how evolution works. That's why proteins do things like being structures. They are receptors for signals. They are the signals themselves. So a protein will, one protein will be a signal, another protein will receive that signal. They are carriers and channels. They are things that defend us from invaders when it comes to immunity, for instance. They transport things. There's all kinds of jobs for proteins. Nucleic acids are informational molecules, of course, for both DNA and RNA. They both carry information. Polysaccharides, on the other hand, have two major roles, so we bother to categorize them into one of two categories. So there are structural polysaccharides and there are storage polysaccharides. Structural polysaccharides is pretty self-explanatory. They exist for the sake of playing a structural role, like cellulose, for instance, is a major component of cell walls in plants. It makes it tough. It's a structure. Now, how do you make cellulose? Well, you string together a bunch of glucose molecules. So cellulose, a polysaccharide, a structural polysaccharide, is nothing but glucose. Just many, many glucoses stuck together. Well, that's also true for starch. Starch is also a polymer that uses nothing but glucose as its monomers. So it's just a bunch of glucoses stuck together. But they're hooked together chemically slightly differently and for an entirely different purpose. Starch is a storage polysaccharide, so-called because what's being stored here is energy. It's not for the sake of making something strong or being structural. It's just for the sake of more compactly storing glucose, which is an energy molecule. It's the major fuel of all cells. Just for the sake of storing extra glucose for later use as fuel. Right, this is what plants do when they've made more glucose than they need for their own fuel requirements at the moment, right? When they have enough glucose, they don't just ignore the sun and stop photosynthesizing. They keep making sugars. But they store that sugar for later by more compactly storing it by polymerizing the glucoses into starch. We animals do a similar thing. We hook our glucoses together slightly differently, but we have our own version of storage polysaccharides. What do we call that? Glycogen, right. That's a major function of the liver, for instance, is to take the glucose that spikes in your blood after a meal. You have more than you need for energetic needs and store it for later when you're not eating so that it can be broken down again, yielding those glucoses that you started out with, putting those back in the blood so your brain and therefore you can continue to live. That's the difference between storage and structural polysaccharides. They're not all made out of glucose. By the way, there would be just as much variety, structural variety of polysaccharides as there would be with proteins probably if cells used all the variety. It's just that they don't. There are many, many kinds of monosaccharides, for instance. And so just like you could use all the different amino acids to make an unlimited number of proteins, technically you could do that with polysaccharides. But cells tend to use the same monosaccharides over and over when they polymerize them into polysaccharides. 16 now. Well, we're looking at this polymerization technique that cells use. And an important thing that's being shown here is that if you have two monomers that you're getting together to make a bigger structure, it's not enough to just have the monomers for energetic reasons. You have to activate one of the monomers in order to hook it together to another monomer. And so, in the what's the overall dichotomy within metabolism? What are the two subcategories of metabolism, that is to say? Catabolism and anabolism. Polymerizing is an example of what? Which of those two? No, it's anabolic. Oh, I thought you said catabolic. Polymerization is an anabolic process. It takes smaller things and puts them together to make bigger and more complex things. In general, that is an energetic process. It requires energy. So cells have to activate their monomers first in order for this polymerization to occur. And, as expectedly, the opposite is true for catabolism. Catabolism is breaking down a bigger thing into smaller chunks, which usually yields or releases energy. This is how we get the energy out of the foods that we eat. The foods that we eat are the macromolecules of organisms. Those have energy in their potential energy in the form of the bonds that whatever organisms that we eat made when they made those polymers. We're reversing that process, getting some of the energy out of those polymers, and we eventually put some of that energy to use building our own polymers brand new out of the subunits. All right, so you can see the activation of a monomer here, typically involving ATP, not always, but typically. And C here stands for some sort of carrier molecule, which is basically just a shuttle. It will release the monomers once the polymerization has occurred. But for all three of, it doesn't matter which of the three polymer classes you're talking about here, they're all represented here by the same cartoon, because in all three cases you have a monomer that has an OH sticking off somewhere and an H sticking off somewhere. These are the connection points. All right? So a monomer will have a hydrogen somewhere and a hydroxyl somewhere. When you polymerize two monomers, you're getting together the hydrogen from one and the hydroxyl with the other. And this is exactly why the reaction that takes place is called a condensation reaction or a dehydration reaction, because the hydrogen from one monomer gets popped off, the hydroxyl from the other gets popped off, and if you have an oxygen and two hydrogens, what comes off is water, H2O. That's why it's called a dehydration reaction. One monomer loses the hydrogen, the other the OH, and instead they are hooked directly together. Exactly the reverse process is required for deconstructing this thing, right? What is the opposite of a dehydration or a condensation reaction?
Hydrolysis.
Lysis meaning splitting, and hydro referring to water. So instead of producing the water as a byproduct of building this thing up, when you split it apart, you have to put water in, so that you can then split that water, in essence, providing one of the monomers with the OH and the other monomer with the H, the reverse of polymerization that's seen here. 17. I think this might be the last one of this chapter. Here we're looking at the idea of denaturation and renaturation. Denaturation refers to a pretty drastic change in the shape of a molecule. And typically, we're talking about polypeptides or proteins, although other macromolecules can be denatured as well. Denaturation is a big deal for proteins because of what I've said a little bit ago. A protein does its important job, whatever it is for that specific protein, because of its shape. If it doesn't have that shape, because that shape has changed, then it no longer can do its job. And that's why denaturation can be dangerous. which is exactly why we try, as part of our homeostasis, to maintain conditions such that denaturation does not occur. All right, this is why we defend a body temperature, for instance, because if you change the temperature, then you change the shape of proteins, and they no longer function as well. Similarly for pH, which we also keep in very strict, a very tight range. So you have a native molecule with a certain shape. That shape is important because it gives it its ability. If conditions are changed, you can denature the molecule. And if it's denatured sufficiently, then it will basically ruin that molecule. If it's a slight denaturation, and further, if you restore the original conditions, then it might renature, go back into its functional shape. This can happen, but if the denaturation is severe, basically that particular molecule is now worthless, except as a source for subunits. If you break the thing back down into monomers, they can be recycled to build a new one, of course. So proteins are always being produced and always being taken out of commission because they get denatured and become worthless as far as function is concerned. All right, that's a chapter.